Okay. So I don't know if I'll be able to answer all the questions, Mark. I don't think I will. But I'll first make some kind of transition between Vladislav's talk and my own talk. So let me consider again. Let me consider again the phase diagram of helium. Okay? I've put some additional things here, which are the proportion between. This is the amount of. Yes. This is the amount of superfluid with respect to total fluid, and this is the amount of normal fluid. And this is the Lander transition here. Okay, at normal pressure, so 1 atmosphere. So you can see indeed that, I mean, below 1.1 degrees, you really have a kind of saturation and negligible quantities of normal fluid. That's just the point I wanted to make. Okay, now let me make another point, which is a general question of what kind of modeling do we have of fluid flows here. So obviously when you are on the right of the Lander line, you just use the Navier-Stokes equation, I mean, because it's a normal viscous fluid. Now as Vladislav said to us, when you are below the Lander line, you have Landau's two fluid model, which contains very important physics, in particular the second sound waves, entropy waves, and you have also superfluid vortices with quantized circulation. Okay? And now you have phenomenological things like mutual friction, which is couples the superfluid vortices with the two fluid model. Now within the two fluid model, you have in some sense to impose the quantum of circulation of the quantum vortices. It doesn't come out naturally. Okay, it does come out naturally though through a description of a macroscopic wave function for the Bose-Einstein condensate. Okay, now there is this other type of description which tries to give a dynamical description of the superfluid in terms of the evolution of a macroscopic wave function. This is called the Gross-Pitayevsky equation approach, and it has several drawbacks and several points in its favor. The main drawback is that there is no well-known or well-agreed-upon way to include normal fluid in the Gross-Pitayevsky equation. So when you are working with the Gross-Pitayevsky equations, you are basically dealing only with superfluid. So, with regard to helium, this obviously means, you know, that you cannot take into account second sound, you cannot take into account the presence of a normal fluid, and so this seems to be very, very bad. But although if you look at these curves, you see that below 1.1 or 1.2 degrees, you can say, well, let's forget the normal fluid because there is so few of it anyway. And maybe I can use a Gross-Pitayevsky equation there. Okay, now what are the good points of Gross-Pitayevsky equation? The good points are, first, it contains naturally the quantum vortices with the correct amount of velocity circulation. And second, it describes them without any singularity, just as the nodal line of a complex wave functions. So it does contain a natural description of phenomena such as reconnection of vortex lines, which if you use a more complex phenomenological description, you have to input some ad hoc recipes to reconnect vortex lines, and it's rather messy, whereas this point is clean with Gross-Pitayevsky equation. Okay. Yes?
That's about the mean free path in helium. If you lower the temperature and you go below 1K, the mean free path in helium is comparable with any size of apparatus. And at something like 0.1K, it's astronomical. So the hydrodynamic description is meaningless anyway.
For the normal fluid.
Yes,
the normal fluid becomes ballistic. The phonons are ballistic, so they don't form really a fluid with it.
Other models generalizing Gross-Pitayevsky where normal component is included?
There are several of them, but to my opinion, none of them is really satisfactory, especially if you look at the following point. The very nice thing about Gross-Pitayevsky model is that it's non-singular on vortex lines, and as far as I know, the proposed models incorporating the normal fluid have singularities on the vortex lines. So they have terms like Vn minus Vs square, for instance, which are singular on the vortex line, and problems like that. But I think it's kind of an interesting open problem. So let me just say a few words about the Tabling experiment so that we can sort of... The Tabling experiment is inside the liquid helium, and he has two counter-rotating disks, okay, inside the cryostat, and he has probes. This disk is rotating like that. This disk is rotating in the other side, and here he has probes which are, as we've said, seen pitot tubes. So the important thing I think one should consider from the Tabling experiment is first, of course, I just showed them to you the spectrum you get. That's the same one you've seen before, which are in the viscous regime Kolmogorov and in the 95% of superfluid Kolmogorov again. So, but there is something even simpler, which maybe will make an easier link to my talk, which is just basically measure the torque on the rotating disks. Because, I mean, the basis of Kolmogorov theory, of course, is that energy injection is independent of viscosity. Okay? So here, you are measuring if the disks are rotating at constant speed, the couple times the speed of rotation is the amount of energy injection in the flow. And so this is a very easy way, is to change the temperature in the experiment. So here I'm in a viscous liquid helium, and here I'm in superfluid helium, and here is the amount of superfluidity that I've represented here from 0 to 100%. And here are the torques. Okay, and you can see that absolutely nothing spectacular happens to the torque. Okay, now the link with my talk is I'm going to talk about superfluid turbulent drag, and the drag is the equivalent of the torque if you think of an object moving through a superfluid. Okay, so I'm going to talk about drag mechanisms in superfluids. Last thing. That is, I think, important. It's, I told you that, well, maybe in this region where we have a lot of superfluid and zero normal fluid, we can use Gross-Pitayevsky equation. However, there is no simple derivation of Gross-Pitayevsky equation that is mathematically sound, because helium is a liquid, and it has strong interactions between each atoms. Okay? It turns out that there is a simple microscopic model of Bose-Einstein condensation for gas with weak interaction, that is quasi-perfect gases. This is called the Bogolyubov model. Okay? And this was basically a mathematical curiosity until some recent times, where people achieved Bose-Einstein condensations in atomic vapors. Okay, so my talk will be about the Gross-Pitayevsky equation, how it contains a description of drag. Okay, and I will be applying it to basically two systems, physical systems, helium, but also atomic condensate. Okay, so this work has been done with Caroline Nord and Christian Weppe, and it's been published recently in March. Okay. So, now, talking about this problem of superfluid drag, I'll be first briefly being defined the nonlinear Schrödinger equation, which is another name for the Gross-Pitayevsky equation. Then, now this is an interesting thing, is there is an extrinsic, extrinsic, intrinsic nucleation thing. There is an interesting intrinsic nucleation mechanism that is basically two-dimensional that has been proposed some time ago by Pomo and Rica, and we will go into that. And then the real world being three-dimensional, trying to see what the three-dimensional effects are, and then we'll talk about the relations to the experiments. Okay. Now, short history of Bose-Einstein condensation. So the theory is from for non-interacting gases from the 20s. The only system known was helium-4 until very recently ago, 5 years ago. And, there has been a continuous development of optical atomic techniques since the 80s, and especially Doppler and evaporative cooling in optical magnetic traps. So, 5 years ago, they observed the first Bose-Einstein condensates in atom vapors. Here was the GLA, MIT, and in Houston. And it's been a popular thing to do if you have enough money, of course, because it's rather expensive. And there's something like 20 now, I think, between 15 and 20 experiments around the world. Okay. Now, the problem we will address here, there are two aspects to it. We will see that one aspect is if I'm moving an object very quickly through the condensate, then I will get turbulence and a turbulent drag. And now there is, it's a famous problem in superfluidity, there is a critical speed below which you have no drag at all, okay? So the first thing we will study before talking about what the drag should look like in the turbulent regime is how does one get the onset of drag in the first place. Okay, and there is a recent experiment using Bose-Einstein condensates here where they have, what they have done basically is they use as an obstacle, they use a laser beam, and they basically scan it through the condensate using a constant velocity, so they scan it like that. And what they find basically is that when the scan velocity is below some critical velocity, there is no heating of the condensate. Okay? And above a critical velocity, which they determine in this way, they find that the condensate is heating. Okay, so that there is some amount of energy that is transferred from the moving laser beam to the condensate, and they interpret this as the onset of dissipation. Okay. So now, let me define the system we are going to study mathematically or numerically. This might look a little complicated, but it is not. It is just the action principle, a simple functional that will give you the Gross-Pitayevsky equation and the equation in a fluid dynamical form. So in the action you have two parts. This part is just to give you the DDT term, the nonlinear Schrödinger equation, and this is the energy functional. And the energy functional itself has two parts, one which is really the energy, and the other one is a Lagrange multiplier that we will see will impose a uniform velocity on the flow. Okay? And now the energy itself is the normal energy which you should have to get nonlinear Schrödinger equation, plus a potential term that will describe the obstacle. We will describe the obstacle by a repulsive potential that will take the fluid away. Okay, so it's a simple matter to... The potential, by the way, is given by a very simple functional form. It's just basically a top hat potential that represents the cylinder. So you basically take away the fluid inside a disk, and you adjust, and those are details, you adjust the length scale so that everything is well resolved, etc. And by the way, this is done with using spectral methods, so you can check.
Oh, it's
defocusing. Yes, yes, because it describes the fluid with a positive compressibility, no instability. Okay, so it's, well, I'm coming into that because, so from the action principle, you get the following nonlinear Schrödinger equation. Okay, so the potential, this term here is coming from the potential. And now, I hear you get the simple fluid dynamical representation, standard fluid dynamical representation of nonlinear Schrödinger equation. The equation is for the macroscopic wave function. And if you consider that the amplitude is the square root of the density and the phase is the potential of velocity, okay, this equation is completely equivalent to standard fluid mechanical equations plus a so-called quantum pressure term that has more derivatives. Okay, so but obviously, so you understand like that you get a compressible fluid and everything, and also it's simple topological argument here to see that if there is a simple zero in this complex function, then this transformation fails. Okay, so in the sense of the transformation, there is a singularity, although there is no singularity inside the equation itself. And as far as its dynamics is concerned, there is a singularity to go into fluid dynamical variables. And it is simple matter to check that when you have a simple zero in this wave, this corresponds to a quantum vortex with the correct amount of vorticity circulation. That's a nice feature of it. So what we have done basically here is just to include a moving obstacle in the standard nonlinear Schrödinger equation description of a fluid. Yes. So we have a compressible fluid. To answer Peter's question, if the equation had been here a plus defocusing, then what I would get here is a change. If it had been focusing, excuse me, I would have a different equation of state. Okay. This is the term, where is it? The term that is in here, c square o. This would change the sign of c square, in fact, here. And it would change the sign of this term. And I would get, instead of a propagation, I would get c imaginary, so instability at large scale, okay? So, as a matter of fact, if I want to define the physical quantities of my fluid, I can define them using two parameters. One, this is a compressible fluid at large scale, so it has a speed of sound, okay? And so this is one of my parameters, and it is C. And the second parameter is, as I said, I have an extra quantum pressure term here, and this extra quantum pressure term turns out to be defined by a length scale, okay? And this length scale turns out to be associated to the non-standard part of this switch, which is, for instance, it is the vortex core size, okay? Or it is also the length scales below which dispersion sets in the sound waves. And this is called the coherence length. And this is what, in the case of helium, is one angstrom, okay? So if I'd want to use this for helium, the best I could do would be to plug in the C velocity of sound of helium, which is, I don't know, 200 or 300 meters per second, and I would plug in this as an angstrom, and this is my theory for helium. See? And in a Bose-Einstein condensate, I will need, and these people doing the experiment, they provide it to you, they say the coherence length is so-and-so, and we have measured the speed of sound by doing this and that. So if you want to make comparisons with experiments in Bose-Einstein condensates, you have to know two quantities, speed of sound, coherence length.
Is that what you mean by the correct amount of circulation you put in?
The correct amount? No. Well, it's related, yes. Okay, maybe I should... Right. Well, you see, the velocity of sound is the velocity, and the coherence length is the length, and the circulation is a circulation, so it's a length time velocity. So if you take the product of the two and there is some square root of 2 and pi, you get the circulation. Mm-hmm. And the circulation itself, you can express it easily in terms of the Planck constant and the mass. Okay, so you have different ways to parameterize the theory. If you like to think like a hydrodynamist, you like to think that you have a velocity of sound and a length scale. But if you are rather quantum mechanically oriented, then maybe you prefer to think that you have a mass of condensed atoms and a Planck constant. And if you do that, you get the combination which is the quantum of circulation. So. Well, if Bogoliubov's theory is okay, which works only for atomic vapors, there are expressions of these length scales in terms of the density and in terms of a characteristic of the interaction, which is called the scattering length, which is some other length scale, and you have expression for those. I mean, I don't have them here, so you can compute it. You can also measure it. And again, in the case of helium, it turns out to be an atomic length scale.
Can you have shockwaves in school?
Well, if you start, obviously, as long as the length scale is such that this term is negligible, it behaves just as a compressible Eulerian flow, so it starts building up a shockwave. However, it turns out when you do simulation, for instance, or that this term is enough to make a regularization of the shockwave. But it's a dispersive regularization, not a dissipative one. So basically what you get is a lot of the energy being radiated away by wave trends. And, some people try to make sense of that mathematically using some kind of I'm thinking of Livermore, for instance. And people like that. It's a difficult mathematical problem, but for numerical people like me, you know, you can check very easily in a 1D simulation of this. You set up the flow so that it would make a shockwave, and then you integrate it using spectral methods. You look at the spectrum, and everything stays perfectly well. You get exponentially decaying spectrum, and so you know that this term is enough to kill the shockwave.
What's the magnitude?
It really depends, but in the case of helium, it's something like, I think, 200-300 meters per second. But in the case of both condensates,
but that's not the second...
No, it's first sound. You have no second sound because you are at low temperature, so you have no... These things, unfortunately, do not exist in this description. You have no finite temperature effect. That's that side about it. Okay. So now let's talk about, first of all, about what is known about the 2D system. Well, a first remark, so the problem is the problem of critical speed. You know, I'm moving a cylinder in a 2D flow and I want to know what happens when I increase the velocity. First of all, the system is described by two parameters, two dimensionless parameters. One is the Mach number. Okay, which is associated to the velocity I'm moving the cylinder. And the other parameter is the ratio of this length scale, okay, to the diameter of the cylinder. Okay. And now, it turns out that Frisch, Pomorica have done some 8 or 9 years ago some very nice 2D simulations of this system, and they conjecture the existence of a saddle node bifurcation. And together with the student, I was able to actually find this saddle node bifurcation using some special branch following method, basically using Newton methods to follow the stationary solution even when they are unstable. Okay, and what you find is, as is written here, you find a saddle node and peak fork bifurcation. Maybe if I show them to you, it's going to be better. So these are things that are well established. Huh? So here are some results. So this is the free energy. This is the Mach number. This is the free energy, the thing that is minimized in the functional approach. And these are three different values of psi over d, which is so the ratio of the coherent length of the fluid to the length to the diameter of the cylinder. So you see that there is a weak dependence of the critical Mach number when psi over d is increased. Now, why do we want to increase psi over d? And you will see why I was so happy to have those atomic vapor experiment. The point is, when we run computation, psi over d is going to be something like a hundredth, maybe, you know. But you can't, as psi is the smallest scale in your computation, and d is the diameter of the cylinder, you cannot take it below, say, 1/100, something like that. And in an experiment in helium, psi is going to be an angstrom, and d is going to be the diameter of the actual object you are moving in the flow. So it is bound to be something astronomically small. And so you'll have problems with numerical simulation. Whereas you will see that in those atomic vapor experiments, that I love those guys, you have a psi over d that are comparable to what you can do, you know, numerically. That was just... So anyway, you do find at reasonable value, numerically reasonable values of psi over d, you do find bifurcation, so you have a stable branch, and here you have two unstable branches. I will not go into the details. And I just tell you that the stable branch has no vortices, and the unstable branches have one and two vortices. Maybe I can show them to you so that I remind you of what the Frisch-Pommeau mechanism is. Yeah, I have a representation of those here. It's a little small. This is the stable one. This one here has one vortex around, and it is unstable. And this one here has two vortices around, and it is also unstable. Okay? But those three states are stationary solutions of the problem. So if you plug them in a non-inertial Schrödinger equation, they stay the same. Okay? And they exist until the critical speed. Okay? And they stop existing after the critical speed because they destroy with each other. First, this one and this one destroys through a pitchfork, and then the remaining one and this one destroy through a saddle node bifurcation. And for speeds higher than the critical speed, you have no more stationary solution. Now, what happens, this is a nucleation solution, and what happens when you are below the critical speed is that you start, this is what you see here, your system starts spitting pairs of counter-rotating vortices, and this is an effective dissipation mechanism. So, this is rather academic now. Why is it rather academic? First, it is two-dimensional. Okay? Second, there are the limitations I talked about, psi over d. And third, what kind of velocity do you get out of that? Well, you've seen before, the velocity is half the velocity of sound. Because in fact, you know, what happens is that you get these solutions like that and like that. You can get them as long as the velocity here is not larger than the velocity of sound.
What are you plotting there, Mark?
This is the cylinder.
Okay.
This is the flow, and this is a pair of vortices. So I'm plotting this. This is the density. Yes. So it's got a. That's why it's a very. It's
Can we do that single contour for the vortex? What are you drawing? Some density.
This thing or this thing?
Yeah, you draw contours for vortices.
This is density control, simply.
But you said those are the vortices.
Yes, because the vortices are zero lines of the string function, so the density goes to zero on the vortex.
The depressions and density of those contours.
Yes.
That's
a strange representation. That's one of my students who likes to do artistic, you know, visualization. But basically, if you forget what's on the top, what you have here is contour lines of density. Okay, so the vortex appears as a... Well, so, as I said, the critical speed here is when you get speed of sound over here. And you know there is a classical result for incompressible flows, which is the Eulerian flow around the cylinder. The velocity here is twice the velocity at infinity. So basically, to have the speed of sound here is you have Mach number 1/2. Okay, so that's why you get, you know, that's a rough argument, but that's why you...
It's a very large speed, right?
It is. That's the point. When I say academic, it's very, very large speed, because in experiments, they have speeds that are much less than the speed of sound. However, if you look at the Landau, standard Landau argument for the critical velocity, you get for phonons something which is of the order of speed of sound, and for rotons, I think this makes something like 30 meters per second. 60, okay, sorry. But anyway, this doesn't exist in our description here, but it is still the order of speed of sound. So this is a general problem in the theory of superfluidity that, well, the theoretical critical speed is of the order of the speed of sound, and this is much too high compared to the experiment. Yes?
So you assume that the fluid is rotational, right?
Well, not really, no.
It's built in here.
Yeah. Well, that's
so
what...
So you cannot take seriously...
it is rotational in the sense... It is rotational. This is... you have circulation here.
It's a gradient and...
You see, maybe this is an important point, so maybe I'll make it very clear here. Okay? Look, you have psi, which is square root of rho e to the I phi. Okay? And V is equal to grad phi. Okay? Now, suppose you have a simple zero here. So that on this line you have, say, real part of psi equals zero, and on this one you have imaginary part of psi equals zero. So obviously rho is zero here. Okay? Rho is zero here. But what happens to phi? Now if you just think for a moment, you will see that when you go around this, phi goes by a factor 2 pi. Okay? So this means that when you look at that, you say it's irrotational. But it's irrotational except on zero lines of phi where you have a problem with the transformation. So in this sense, this flow is rotational.
But then I'm a little confused, because before you said that below transition you have the rotation, and above transition you're thinking about this.
Yes.
It looks like you already have it below transition.
Okay. This is Mach number. This is critical Mach number. I have to simplify things. I have a saddle node, so it's like that. This solution is stable. This solution is unstable. Okay? They are both stationary. And this one is irrotational, and this one is rotational. Okay? So when I draw a plot at speeds below the critical speed, I have both a stable irrotational solution, which is this one, and an unstable rotational solution, which is this one. Okay? Now, if I perturb this one a little bit, it will spit a pair of vortices. Now, what I'm saying is that, by continuity, when you go here, you take the system here, where there is no stationary solutions, the way the system behaves when it's at supercritical velocities is by spitting in a time-periodic way pairs of vortices. And that's really what you find in simulations, and that's the original idea of Fumarika. What we did was just to find the solutions which they didn't have, the unstable ones.
Did you study this kind of turbulence and isn't this problem above transition?
Well, that's... let's see, as long as you stay two-dimensional, first of all, you're going to study at best two-dimensional turbulence, okay? So one of the motivations for the work I'm talking about today is to try to look at three-dimensional behaviors, which nobody had done before. That's what I'm going to talk about. Now, as far as two-dimensional problems go, what you can do, for instance, this we have done, is to try to study how the frequency of a vortex emission scale with the distance to criticality. Okay, and you find some scaling law. Well, there are several problems like that. But again, it's rather academic in the sense that it's a 2D problem, and especially before those atomic vapor experiments, it was very academic because the system was computed for psi over d equals a tenth or a 50th, and the real case in helium experiment would be something like 10 to the minus. Well, but I haven't seen any experiment. The only experiments I've seen up to now that have something to do with this academic framework were done using atomic vapors. They were not done using helium. Okay, so before I go to the 3D problem, let me say what happens when you decrease psi over d. Yes.
What's the connection between Costello's and Talbot's theory and this? Because in Costello's and Talbot's theory, you have a pair of bound dislocations, right? And there are always there. That's very similar to this.
Yes. Yes.
And you increase the temperature and you have a transition where these dislocations grow apart. So you see this analogy there?
Well, it's really, in Costello's theory, you are talking about transition in equilibrium thermodynamics when you change the temperature. Okay, so when you are talking about Costello-Stirless, you are talking about a system that is in thermal equilibrium, okay, and you vary the temperature, and then it is the same system as the one we are studying here, that it is a two-dimensional superfluid, okay, so in this sense the vortices are the same, yes, but they are not the same in the sense that you consider them in thermal equilibrium in Costello-Stirless, and here we are at T equals zero, and we are putting a solicitation to the system which is a moving obstacle, and which you cannot describe as a thermal excitation. I mean, it's something completely out of equilibrium. You are taking a zero temperature fluid and moving an obstacle at finite speed in it. See? So the vortices are the same, but they are not similar.
Right. There is a dynamical physics, which is the ground of possible stories, which tells you that with energy, not temperature, but energy, the pair, it is, the bound state exists, the firing is done. This says there is a dynamical background
of Costello's statistics. That is the pairs that you generate by the Pomo-Frisch mechanism. The pair of counter-rotating vortices you generate are exactly the equivalent of Costello's service pairs, but they are seen in a completely different context. Okay, so now, I try to finish summarizing the 2D results before I go to 3D. So the 2D results is that when you decrease psi over d, Mach number decreases, and there is all indications that in the limit psi over d goes to zero, you get the critical Mach number of the Euler flow. I mean, which is something natural in some sense, because the difference from Euler is coming from this psi term in the equation, and I'm taking it to zero. But however, it's sort of interesting because, for instance, if you draw these diagrams with psi over d going to zero, it looks a little bit like that. That's smaller value and smaller again. So when I'm finally getting to the Euler flow, I don't really have a bifurcation. I have rather a single branch like that that ends up with a very bad singularity here. And that's what I get for psi equals zero. Okay, so mathematically the limiting process is interesting. Anyway, well, in Euler, you see, you can find only Euler has this branch. I mean, if you start in non-linear Schrodinger equation on this branch, you can take the limit. But because this is the irrotational branch. But if you start from this branch, remember you have quantum vortices on this branch. So obviously it's a very bad limit when you take psi to zero because you have this vortex that is shrinking down in size and going down to the cylinder. Okay, so only this branch has a limit, and then it's the classical problem of a limit velocity in Euler equation, which is, I mean, you can find it doing Euler trichomy things in the Landau book. I mean, there are tons of literature about this problem. So it's just an original way, let's say, to compute them. Critical. No, it's not really 1/2, you see, because 1/2 would be, 1/2 is the ratio of velocity when the flow is completely incompressible, but here it has finite compressibility, and therefore what you really want is to have the Mach number at the near the cylinder to go to 1/2, and now this is a local Mach number because the velocity of sound is depending on density, so you have to take that into account. And it's a non-trivial thing to compute the critical velocity, but it has been done, and you can check that this thing converges to the Euler critical velocity. So it's something like a 0.35, you can find people...
No, in the opposite limit of large Xi.
Ah, large Xi?
Yeah.
Ooh, large Xi. I don't know.
Like a needle moving, a point...
Yes.
Point disturbance.
You will probably get, I don't know if you get one half of the spin of sound. Probably you'd get C, I would believe. Logically. No. Actually, Hakim has done this problem. Some guy in my lab, he has done this problem in 1D nonlinear Schrodinger equation using a delta potential. So that would be like what you want. And you get... So you have one more thing, which is the strength of the potential, because you've got G delta, you have some number here. So then you get a critical velocity that depends on this number. That is the strength. You get some critical velocity that depends on the strength of the potential, meaning the term in front of the delta function. Okay? And this can be done analytically in 1D, by hand. Yes.
1D.
1D.
What is
1D? It's a flow in 1D with a... Yes, well, it's a flow in a tube with the potential. No, you have no vorticity, but that's...
You're talking
about the irrotational limit. In the 1D flow, you also have... This has been done by Hakim. The reference are in the PRL, I think. Anyway, I can give you the reference. And then you have no vortices. Of course, you are in 1D, but you find a saddle node bifurcation again, which you can compute analytically. And then the equivalent of the vortices are gray solitons that are emitted by the system. So everything works out nicely. Okay, but I want to go 3D, not 1D. So let me make the transition now to 3D. How do we use this knowledge about 2D stationary solutions to start a 3D computation? First of all, a 3D computation is going to be something very expensive, and so you want to be, control things. So after trying several things, we finally found a common way of preparing our system, which is a simple idea. The idea is, what can I do? What do I know to do when I'm in 2D? I know how to compute the stationary solutions, either with zero vortex, one vortex, or two vortex, or two vortices. So I can use that knowledge to make a 3D field. How? Well, I can make, say, an interpolation between a one vortex field and a zero vortex field. And what will this do on the 3D thing? Well, when I have zero vortex, I have zero vortices. When I have one vortex, I have one vortex. So what will happen in 3D, what will happen if I do this interpolation is I will decorate my cylinder by a vortex loop, okay? Because by continuity, when I will interpolate from zero vortex to one, the vortex lines will have to come out from the cylinder for topological reasons. And so I will prepare a 3D solution that locally will be stationary, and I can then ask myself, okay, if I start real 3D nonlinear Schrodinger equation dynamics, what happens? Well, it turns, yes?
Still one more question. Is it the first order transition or second order transition which you have in 1 and 2D? What is the other parameter?
What transition are you talking about?
This bifurcation.
It's a standard saddle node bifurcation, I mean.
Which is first order, second. Is it a jump or?
No jump. No. It's first, second order.
It will be the same.
No. You mean talking about. Yeah, it's supercritical. Okay? That is it's supercritical. That is when you are below the. That's one of the things we will look at. But in 2D, we've looked into that very in details. We were absolutely unable to get subcritical vortex nucleation. I mean, sustained subcritical vortex nucleation. So it's really supercritical in 2D. And that obviously was a problem because the predicted 2D critical speed being critical velocity being so high, we have to find some mechanism for subcriticality if you want to, and it will turn out that this mechanism will be 3D. In 2D, no. So the answer to your question is, in your terminology, second order. There is no hysteresis. Okay, you get. Okay, so I was reluctant to use second order. I would say. Okay, so what would I say? I would say that you have three types of Andronov bifurcation, right? Type 1, type 2, type 3. Okay, and this is the supercritical type, which is, I don't remember if it's 2 or 3. So there is, in terms of Andronov bifurcation, there is no hysteresis. Okay? Does that satisfy everybody? And the scalings are the naive scalings you expect. Time scales like one over the distance to criticality to the 1/2, and no hysteresis. We were expecting to have the other type of Andronov thing in 2D and understand the subcritical velocities like that, but it turned out not to be the case.
I'm not sure what you meant by loop of circulation. You
have
a picture of that? You said
you have a cylinder. Yes. This actually is my, well, yes, I'll show it hiding the rest, because it's a preview. Can you see it?
So where's the loop? Oh, I see.
You see it?
The handle.
That's, again, these students who likes fancy graphics. It's kind of hard to see. But you see, here I'm in the one vortex solution, and here I interpolate on this length, and then I am in zero vortex. And that's my preparation, this thing I will stop. Yes, initial data. Now, before I show the rest, I just say what we obtain. We obtain complicated behavior, but you can sort of understand it because you have two different time scales. On a short time scale, this thing has a problem and has a very fast evolution. Okay, that we will see next. And then on a longer time scale, it has another type of evolution. Okay, the first short time scale is this one. So I'll show the whole thing now. See? And what it does is basically it generates semi-circular loops that are quasi-stationary, that don't move on the short time scale, fast time scale. And actually, doing this is radiating energy. So here you have a state where it has two of these loops, you know, and then it's resonating and radiating some energy. And here you have only one. Okay? So on a fast time scale, although locally in 2D this is stationary, and locally in 2D this is stationary, obviously this part is not, you know. There is, by the way, for those who are interested in the fluid dynamical part, very important differences between vortex rings and vortex pairs. Is the velocity of a pair is just the velocity of each vortex seen by the other vortex. Whereas when you have a ring, there is a log term that comes with it. So for a given size, a ring goes much faster by a logarithmic term than a pair. So you see that there is a non-trivial thing, problem going on here. Here you have the 2D stationary thing, which is at the correct distance to be stationary in 2D, and it's manufacturing a stationary 3D vortex loop, which has a different diameter. Okay? And it's doing this by itself. Well, in some way you could argue that this is rather trivial, because either the thing vanishes completely, or if it has to have some sustained existence, it has to be quasi, on a short time scale, it has to be quasi-stationary. And now you know that the quasi-stationary structures are loops. So, you know, it makes sense that it manufactures a loop. What is interesting, though, is that it has some kind of built-in mechanism to select the correct loop, which, by the way, these loops have been considered for many, many years by people in helium as a nucleation solution. So it's sort of nice to see them coming out naturally from the 3D simulation here. So I put some data here. I'm 5'5". I'm almost wrong. Okay.
Here you are the low transition, right?
I am slight. I have to be below transition because above I wouldn't have the. But I'm slightly below, yes. R, however below I want to be, but I'm below, obviously, because I need the stationary solutions to build my solution. So anyway, one can check that the diameter, there is a relation between the speed and the diameter of the loop, and one can check that indeed the diameter is selected that has the correct speed, local speed. There. And now we go to the interesting point, which is what happens on a longer time scale. So I'm here, I have this little loop on the side of my cylinder, and now I wait and see what happens, okay? And I remember that as I'm below critical speed, if I were in a 2D situation, nothing would happen, because as I said, nothing happens in 2D. But here, depending on the parameters, sometimes we have the luck to see sustained 3D vortex stretching. So this is a purely three-dimensional mechanism to extract energy from the flow and put it in the vortex line. And this is happening at subcritical velocity. So now, we'll finish my results. We've made a whole...
The dynamics of this thing in
two things can happen in long time. Either the little loop moves forward, and then it is slammed against the cylinder and disappears, and so you're back to your rotational flow. Or it can be drawn behind the cylinder, and then it starts being pulled and 3D stretched like that. And then there is a number of interesting questions with this flow that I have no time to get into, such as do the anchor points move at a finite length or not, and many, many interesting questions. That's another interesting question that I have no answers. I don't know. And it's an interesting question, but I think it should be studied not with non-inertial linear equation, but with the line vortex methods. It would be much easier. But there are many interesting questions like that.
Mark, do you think of this as the analog of the symmetry breaking bifurcation behind the
circuit? Well, I would say if we go just. Well, I would say that this is a sort of nucleation solution that if you are talking about intrinsic nucleation, you need some fluctuation, either quantum mechanical or thermal, that will nucleate this, and then you are in business because you can stretch it, and you know, you are starting some drag. Okay? But now if you have extrinsic vortices, like in helium, I don't think you need this guy to start, but it's just our way of using. So let me just... the question is, it can be stretched or not stretched. So we've varied the parameters with a number of runs, and so the runs are summarized here. So in some cases we had stretching, and in other cases we had no stretching. And when we had stretching, we computed a drag coefficient. I'll come back to that on the next... What?
The last column?
The last column is Cx.
Yes.
The same Cx as for cars. The force divided by the surface and... Okay. What? Yeah. This is on two transparencies. Because first, we'll go to the CX and transparency now n plus 2. N plus 1 is the difference between stretching and non-stretching. So I put them on here, on a pi over d max plot. The line here is the 2D critical velocity. So it's unstable above, stable below. And now the points are vortex stretchings, and the cross are no stretching. Okay? And those are all the runs, and the star is the experiment in atomic vapor I mentioned first. Okay? Now, so it seems that there is definitely, we can definitely get subcritical stretching, and now the non-trivial question is, how does the amount of subcriticality scale when psi over d is going down to zero? And mind you, those are very big runs, each one of them takes hours. So, now the CX, by the way, in order to see if this is a robust mechanism or not for drag generation, we've defined the CX just like that. I mean, the CX is defined as the force on the cylinder divided by the density and divided also by U square and the surface. It's the standard of the fluid mechanical definition of Tx. And so we get Cx of order 1. We define the surface by using the anchor length and the diameter of the cylinder. So this means it's an efficient drag mechanism. Now, I go to my conclusion, okay, which is that, first of all, in this thing, you can define RS, superfluid Reynolds number. I don't know if it's a correct definition, but the point is that the quantum of circulation, gamma, has the dimension of viscosity, of a kinematic viscosity. So you can use it to define the dimensionless Reynolds type number thing. And so now you can study the non-dimensional drag coefficient as function of the superfluid Reynolds number. And the question, interesting question, for instance, for experimentalists, if superfluid turbulence, the one that was addressed in the preceding talk, which is really, we are in transitional regimes in what I've done, but now suppose that you are taking the limit where the superfluid Reynolds number is going to infinity, then somehow you must hit the superfluid turbulent regime, and then you can ask a question of universalities. So one of those questions is that it is well known in the Navier-Stokes flow that you have a non-trivial Cx as function of Reynolds number, you know, that has drag crisis and everything, that is well documented. Now an open question to people doing experiments in helium would be, can one determine experimentally the same Cx as function of superfluid Reynolds in low temperature helium, and is it the same or is it different? That, I think, is an interesting open question. But anyway, in summary, so we definitely have found a new mechanism of a subcritical efficient drag mechanism. Interestingly enough, the numerical simulations were quantitatively comparable to experiments in the dilute atomic vapor case, which is not the case for helium. And then, what I said before, maybe it's possible. I don't know, because there it's a question really of experiments in helium. But you know, my point is, you don't have to measure things as complicated as a Kolmogorov spectrum or things like that. A simple drag coefficient, you know, would be enough. I mean, it would be quite stunning if it's really the same as the viscous one. And well, that would be my conclusion. Well, you know, Reynolds number, you need a length scale. You need a length scale. You need what else? Ah, I have this one. I can show you. But you need a length scale. Then you need a velocity scale, so this is obviously independent of your fluid, and then you need a viscosity, kinematic viscosity, and then my proposal is just to use the quantum of circulation, which for the helium case turns out to be of the same order of magnitude as the viscosity. Okay. And the other thing, by the way, to show you how it's the kind of computation I've done are ridiculous in the case of helium, is that here I've plotted on the same graph critical velocity and psi over d. Here are all the things we were talking about, and here are the helium results I could find. So, yeah, obviously, when you are doing this, the simulation is really, really far away from the asymptotically interesting regime.
Do you have pressure distribution around the cylinder when these vortices are being sealed?
Well, obviously, we could get them. I
think that would be very useful already, just to see if it is like the classical distribution of pressure.
Yes. That can be done. Although we are really in only transitional regimes, we've been able to achieve a Kolmogorov-like spectrum, but in very special periodic flows. Here you have to accommodate the cylinder, you know, and everything. So the Reynolds number you can have numerically are not so high. So it wouldn't be really turbulent.
The structure that forms initially was sort of like a pinching pattern. What determines that length scale? Is it the resolution of the mesh and the thickness of the vortex? Why don't you get many little loops going?
Which one? The,
yes, right.
This
no,
one,
yeah.
One.
Yeah, that one, yeah. Why don't you get many loops going? Why
well,
sort of neck down in many places?
Well, you see, the point is that, first of all, they cost energy, these things. So, I mean, they built from the loop we put first.
Well, I thought energy was from your...
The energy is concerned.
Right.
But you cannot...
They have to pay to have a high gradient.
There are structures that locally have energy, you know, they are... So I mean, they are born here by eating up the energy of the original loop. So obviously, I mean, you can make some sort of order of magnitude, and you cannot make a large number of them. Unless you increase, because of course this is totally arbitrary. I decided here to take this length.
I understand, but it's all distance there, right?
How about the partition of energy progress here? You have pieces in the gradient part and pieces in the...
Yes.
Is there any understanding that you can hint?
Oh, yes, obviously, it's because, not on this, very short scale, what you basically see is that you have some sound waves that you don't see here that are radiated away, okay, on this short time scale. And on the longest time scale, when you get 3D vortex stretching, then you get energy flowing from the kinetic energy thing into the line vortex, because it costs, that's the drag mechanism. These vortices cost energy to be stretched. Yes?
And maybe you might mention some experiments that are directly devoted to this program. They have been done by Wilfried Shepard in Regensburg. What he does is that he has a very small sphere, about 0.1 millimeter. It's magnetic. It's levitated in between two magnetic poles, and he oscillates these spheres, and he can change the velocity by which this sphere moves through the magnetic field at very low temperatures of the order of 20 millimeters. And what he finds is a transition between the nominal drag on the sphere and the turbulent drag on the sphere. So for a very low force, he sees the nominal drag.
Although the flow is superfluid.
Yes, everything is superfluid. He can flow very close to the absolute zero. And he sees some intermediate regime where this nominal and turbulent flow can intermittently be switched from one to each other. And he found some interesting conclusions that this rate by which the switching goes on is depending on the irradiation background. So he concludes that it must be some mechanism
intrinsic
to this, and he concludes that this is the background irradiation or something like that. And it's serious, you know, it's serious.
Well,
you can take the source of radioactive rays, and if it places closer to the ground, this rate of switching increases.
Well, this is typically what you'd expect from the existence of a nucleation barrier here. You need to in order to start 3D vortex stretching, you need to cross the nucleation energy barrier, and maybe the only way to do it if your temperature is so low. Is you could do it either through quantum tunneling, and then there are ways to compute the rate of quantum tunneling knowing the barrier, or you can do it through thermal fluctuation. And obviously, if the temperature is low enough, you'll get an exceedingly small rate by thermal fluctuations. So maybe you can use that as a...
The mechanism is different. I mean, if you believe that this is cosmic ray mechanism, so...
Well, it's...
The it's close to that...
And
it's
starts this.
It starts that.
Yes, I'm saying. Yes.
Yeah, I have two questions. One, what happens with this configuration above transition?
If what?
If you're above transition.
Well, we didn't try it because obviously above transition you already have a mechanism, dissipative mechanism in 2D. And our goal was to obtain a dissipative mechanism subcritical, you know, and that's why we ran extensive 3D computation. So although it might be interesting for turbulence purposes to do 3D computation in this regime, we didn't do it. That's something we'll have to do in the future.
But there is transition, right?
Well, there is already transition in 2D, so there must be transition in 3D also. Would be really extraordinary if a 3D effects would kill the transition, you know.
And another question which is related, why did you start from this
geometry. Why not, let's say just...
Because my the codes I have, that it's for purely practical reasons. The numerical codes I have that compute steady states in 2D and that do nonlinear Schrödinger equation integration in 3D are periodic codes. Okay, and so the easiest thing to put in a periodic code was a periodic cylinder. In a sense, it's closed, as you said, but it's closed in the periodicity, in the torus periodicity, in Fourier space. Yes, we tried different things, and
can you study the decay of those, although we're in a different regime than we just talked earlier? You could study the decay of small vortices.
Well, we could, you know, but the problem is that there are so many ways you can make a perturbation of the flow, and really what you want to do is to obtain subcritical vortex stretching. So you want to perturb it in a way that will generate some vortex loops. But now if you do it, you know, if you fiddle with it in any way you have, you do it by adding a very large perturbation. So we figured out that this was the most controlled way in which we could add a little vortex line without, you know, shaking the thing like mad. It depends on the cases. So if it's very complicated behavior, it depends on the periodicity length in Z. For instance, if it is short, the loop can grow and then it will detach as a 1D vortex. Okay. But with long periodicity, we have seen it with a finite vortex attachment length. So, but we don't know if this finite length is an effect of periodicity or if it is an intrinsic thing. What we plan on doing is using vortex line methods to study these types of problems, because a nonlinear Schrödinger equation in 3D is so expensive to integrate, you know, that we couldn't study all those interesting problems.
Thank Mark and reassemble.